And you already have been speaking on this issue since yesterday. You have been congratulated on the good work that you have done, and I do not want to spoil that. This is an opportunity for you to come before the committee and repeat some of the things that you have said, and for the committee to clarify some of the issues with yourself, and in order to set the stage for us when we move into hearings in the few days to come. So without wasting time, I do not want to go through introducing most of the people that you're supposed to be engaging with. We're going to take this briefing from yourself, and after that we will then be looking at we'll take the FFC on the division, the comments on the division of revenue, and after that we'll take a briefing and the formal consideration on the division of revenue. So I was alerted to the fact that the minister also has another engagement and perhaps if you could indicate what, when exactly you are going to be leaving. Over to you, sir.
Thank you very much, Chairperson and members.
The breakfast that the chair refers to is a breakfast where I think none of us had a breakfast to go to where you don't eat, but it's part of what we have to do. Chair, without, I mean, I should just indicate that the discussion will be in, I mean, there's the general discussion on the budget that we'll have, and then we'll ask Deputy DG Fujile to lead the discussion on the division of revenue bill. And in the tradition thereof, the division of revenue bill needs to pass through these portals to get to the MCOP, where it's then treated quite differently. It might be that we may not all be here for that. We all have different engagements in Johannesburg and Pretoria this evening, and eventually later this evening, a number of us are at the same venue for one gathering. We won't be on the same flight, and so you'll allow us that. And but you know, the discussion on the division of revenue bill, I think, is by now quite straightforward. And if we have stayed off the straight and narrow, the FSC will advise you of it, because there'll be a detailed discussion on that. Chair, I'm going to ask the DG, Mr. Chachanyahu, to do the presentation. And the presentation, again, is complex because it talks to two different sets of interests. The first part of the presentation deals with the macroeconomic framework, that which informs the fiscal framework. And the second part of the presentation deals with the allocation, that which will inform the work of the budget, the Joint Budget Committee. In respect of the second set of issues, the Joint Budget Committee, work undertaken at the time of the MTBPS would have been packaged in and taken account of, and so please engage with us about those issues as well. On the tax proposals, I think that we can touch on those generally. That's what we're ready to do. Alternatively, and it's in your wisdom, Chair, you might permit some general discussion with committee with members first, and then we get to the presentation. We're entirely in your hands.
Yeah, having explain to what the process is. Maybe let's
take a presentation.
Take a time to
have that. Thank you.
Thank you, Minister. Thank you, Chair. The 2007 budget has 89.5 billion rand to the forward estimate. We're providing for 534 billion rand in total spending for 2007-2008 to support key policy objectives, namely accelerating economic growth.
Sorry, time out. I don't think that the PA system is working. Do people know? I mean,
but
even though...
But is your mic on?
Yes, the mic is on.
Oh.
But we don't want the DAP
yet. Unfortunately, they have got very trouble. They even hear those that have not been doing, that have not been fair.
If people in France
can
hear them, it's okay.
Yeah, no, we can hear you. But, we can follow it up.
Okay. We are providing for 534 billion rand spending in the 2007-2008 to support key policy objectives. Acceleration of economic growth, which is key to the reduction of poverty and the reduction of the unemployment. And investment in social and economic infrastructure, improvement in the education and health services, modernization of the justice and administrative system, and also investing in long-term income security and thus protecting the vulnerable members of our society. The budget that we have tabled takes place in the context of an improving growth in domestic economy. The growth in non-agricultural sectors has remained strong, and we are the fast growing sectors, including construction, financial, and transport services. And the slide that you have there shows those different components. If you were to strip out agriculture and mining from those figures, you will actually find that the economy is already growing at a rate that is faster than 6%, which is what we are targeting from 2010. In terms of the forecast, we are forecasting growth that is just over 5% per year on average by 2009. The slide that is in line with Giza target, it is actually marginally better than Giza target, because of Giza target is 4.5% average by 2009. Inflation expectations remain within the targeted range of 3 to 6% throughout the forecast period that ends in 2009-2010. The growth has also been underpinned and continues to be underpinned by consumption and investment. The investment spending has gathered momentum as consumption moderates. What we have actually seen has been that growth in investment has been very robust and it continues to grow in double digit figures over the forecast the forecast period. Nevertheless, a combination of rising producer prices and high consumer demand have exerted some upward pressure on inflation. And as I have said earlier on, in spite of that acceleration in inflation that we have seen, we actually, our view is that we are now close to the peak and that we will remain within the targeted range of 3 to 6 over the forecast period. However, we believe that investment could have been growing even faster had it not been that it is in a way constrained by low national savings. What this meant was that we had to augment domestic savings from foreign sources of savings. I think that the key driver of savings has been the corporate sector, household savings. I think we are a nation of or spend that household savings that is actually pretty low. And I think that what you are beginning to see, though, is that government is now coming to the party in terms of its contribution to the national savings effort. That gap between investment and savings led to a current account deficit, which over the forecast period we envisage will remain between 5 and 6% of GDP. The current account balance, the current account deficit does not just reflect the widening imbalance between savings and investment, and it is also reflective of the fact that we are as a country consuming more than what we are producing, and that difference has to come from elsewhere, and that elsewhere being the rest of the world. We have been covered, you can see the financial account, which is the line there, has more than covered the current account deficit. And as a result of that, we read a surplus on the balance of payment, and thus enabling the Reserve Bank to continue to build, to accumulate, to accumulate reserves. The growth challenge for us is a straightforward one. With the kind of imbalances that we have seen, the challenge here is to improve export performance through appropriate trade and industrial policy, and generate more low-skilled jobs and raise the level of productivity. This is the only way, as far as we're concerned, that we could actually have poverty and unemployment by 2014. Minimize the bureaucratic red tape and reduce the regulatory burden. The committee would be pleased to note that we now are going to be establishing a regulatory impact assessment unit in the presidency, which will benefit from the analysis from the Treasury to make sure that we go through this regulatory burden in terms of new legislation and policies that that gets introduced. Of course, we also have to continue to improve the concerns of the public sector, enhance the investment in capacity in the network industry, transport, telecommunications, and so forth. Of course, the strength, the underlying strength of the economy and a solid fiscal position that we found ourselves in has enabled us to continue to grow expenditure at 9% in real terms, but the revenue has grown even faster in recent years, and hence a fiscal position that proposes a surplus for the forthcoming fiscal year. I said earlier on that the household and government have been the laggard in terms of their contribution to national savings. Last year in the third quarter, we began to turn the corner. The government began to become a net saver, and with the budget framework that we have now tabled, we expect that government net saving would continue to improve over the medium term. Increases in capital expenditure relative to current expenditure and a broadly balanced budget will continue to improve the national savings position. The fixed more than 1,000 ways, that is the budget balance broadly, the position broadly in balance over the MTEF. The bar above the line there, which reflects a surplus, the 2006-2007 surplus, that is a surplus we didn't plan for, that is the 5.3 billion. The surplus for 2007-2008, that is the planned surplus of 0.6% of GDP. And you can see that over the period, the budget position remains broadly in balance. Of course, if you eat all your vegetables, you can enjoy the dessert. The same debt quarter continued to decline from 1997, 1998, and you can see that it continues to decline to just about 2.1% of GDP by 2009, 2010. This is a slide, Mr. Chairman, that reflects the benefits of the solid macroeconomic management and fiscal management that we have seen over the past few years. This is beginning to reap the fruit of fiscal consolidation. And it speaks to the fact that we have created fiscal space. And now that we have this space, how do we utilize this space? Of course, the space doesn't just come from the fact that we had run such a solid ship on the expenditure side, but also a story of a remarkable performance on the tax side, the realization of efficiency, but also more importantly, a reflection of the underlying strength of the economy. The budget provides for a net tax relief of 12.4 billion rand. And to highlight the reduction in the FTC and the move towards a dividend with dividend tax from 2008 post 2008, the abolishment of the retirement fund tax, and a myriad of other issues. In the main year, the biggest benefits for the relief has actually been personal income tax given to individuals, and that amounted to 8.4 billion. I said that you have the fiscal state, what do you do with it? The key spending spending issues, investment in stadiums and public transport to ensure a successful 2010 FIFA World Cup. I think that we are beginning to strike the balances right, because the spending on the supporting infrastructure is larger than the spending that we have on the stadium. Also, more importantly, we're increasing the social wage through investment in bulk water and sanitation and other essential services, the elimination of deadlock in social services delivery, with particular attention being paid to the salaries and skills of professionals in the health, education, and social development sector. The programs continue to modernize the state, including improved access to justice, greater policing capacity, and reduction in case backlog. And lastly, the strengthening of regional and international partnerships for peacekeeping and development. How have we slice the cake? You will see from the two pie charts that we have. The top pie chart is to reflect where we were in 2003-2004. Between 2003-2004, the national government took the biggest chunk of national revenue, that's 43%. Local government took 4%, and the provinces were 43%. Whereas the provinces have still remained the same at 43%, the share of local government has doubled from 4% to 8%. And of course, if that increase, then it has to come at the expense of some other sphere, and the share of national government declined to 49% by 2009 to 2010. That's probably in terms of the key areas of the allocation, safety skills, education, health, and welfare, budgetary assistance for grants to households increased from 58 billion rand to 74 billion rand in the outer year of the MTEF. 8.1 billion rand goes for the teacher pay provision and increasing the clerical and support staff in the school. 2.2 billion for higher education and 850 million for adult basic education, and a further allocation for FEG. The money that applied for the new remuneration dispensation for health professionals, we are ramping up the comprehensive HIV and AIDS program. We are making an additional allocation of 1.7 billion rand. The uptake in the program has actually been quite rapid, which gave us the confidence to add additional resources to the program. 1 billion rand for the hospital revitalization program, which again is also a program that is actually running quite rapidly. The Umsobomvu Youth Fund received a one of 400 million rand for recapitalization. This amount is just to keep them afloat. We are still going to, we are still awaiting a proposal for further recapitalization of the Umsobomvu Youth Fund, and it has actually also demonstrated significant success in terms of the program that they have rolled out to young people. I earlier on talked about the network, talked about the investment drive that we are having, infrastructure and economic services. I talked about the investment in Stadia India, about 7.4 billion rand going into national roads, rail and provincial infrastructure, 1.6 billion for targeted sector support and incentive schemes, maybe on the budget of the Department of Trade and Industry. And additional 125 million rand just goes to for the Standard Public Works Program for monitoring and evaluation of the funding. Infrastructure grants for provinces increases from 4.3 billion to 21 billion rand. This is not a new grant chair. It is the same grant that we have always had, except that we didn't like the acronym. A further 2.7 billion rand for integrated housing and human settlement grant. The next set of issues has to do with public administration and prevention of crime. Last chunk going on to policing equipment, 2.4 billion rand, 1.5 billion rand for to improve the administration of justice and deal with the case backlog in the court system. I will pick up the big amount, 4.3 billion rand for defense modernization and military skills development. 1.1 billion goes to home affairs, and 1.3 billion, which is very important, would have to go to the South African Revenue Services for their core systems and the upgrade of customs scanner. We have also tabled this year in the budget review, we introduced a new chapter that began to lay the principles that underline that underpin a social security reform that the president talked about at the time of the State of the Nation. And the principles that is underpin this social security reform are equity, the pooling of risk, a mandatory participation which will include compulsory participation of employees and inclusion of self-employed individuals on a reasonable term, administrative efficiency, and more importantly, social solidarity with minimum benefits assured through the social assistance grant that we currently have on the budget. We would have to continue to strengthen the social security system, and this would have to take place in the form of a standard payroll check system of between, say, 13 and 18% of earnings for all people in informal employment. And this would include individual benefits such as retirement savings, basic disability and death benefits, unemployment insurance and administration. And then, of course, there will be supplementary retirement funding, which may be optional above the threshold, but that we would have to introduce a cap for the tax subsidies that people actually get beyond that amount. To alleviate the burden that would befall low-income earners, we are introducing a wage subsidy as part of this social security reform to encourage job creation and raise the working conditions of low-income earners. This is meant to also fully offset social security contributions by this low income earner. The total annual cost estimate is between 20 and 30 billion rand, and these are just a back of the envelope and calculation, and it is intended that this will help broad sectoral coverage. And I will end it there at this stage and invite any questions.
Thank you. Anything,
Minister?
Members? Mr. Davidson, Mr. Malosha? Mr. McCartney? Mr. Mugoni? Ms. Sotomayor? Elia, oh, I think she's my apologies.
Thank you, Chairman. Just a couple of questions. Well, first of all, the question in respect of the social security system. When I think this is a white paper, certainly a position paper, was brought to this committee, most probably informed me, I think it was about 2 years ago, on the reform of the retirement industry, great pains were stressed that this was a concept document and that there was going to be a good deal of working of that document with particularly the private sector because of the huge ramifications of such a system to the private sector. To what extent has it in fact been workshopped with the private sector in the light of the ramifications that such a social security system would have in that regard? I'm talking about the retirement, National Retirement Fund. And then, second of all, the wage subsidy. Now, when I read the minister's speech, I rather got the feeling that the wage subsidy was connected to the reform of the retirement industry. And what I got the impression was that the subsidy would be used to really subsidize those individuals who couldn't, because of low income, be able to afford the Social Security tax. But reading the document that here, I don't think I'm back to 2013. And looking at your document, your piece on that you've given us here, it seems to go beyond that. And I don't know whether it is now just a subsidy for low income earners in respect of the whole question of the social security system, or whether it's something totally different, a wage subsidy to the employer as opposed to the employee. If we could talk to that. And then finally, Jim, my third question, when one spoke about the industrial policy, I'm just trying to find it here, improve export performance through appropriate trade and industrial policy. But of course, nothing as yet has come out. But can I ask, in terms of industrial policy, can I ask what is concentrated in that context? What does government use, what type of incentive does Treasury intend to incentivize that type of policy? Is it going to be industry specific, or is it going to be project specific, or is there going to be a general incentive?
Thank you, Chair. Two questions are revolving around the issue of the current account. Firstly, Minister, you have indicated in the budget review that there are capacity constraints already in the economy, especially in relation to the steel industry. Now, I just want to find out how we're going to respond to this challenge, because there's going to be massive investment by the private sector and the state-owned enterprise, which then worsens in the process the current account system. I just want to find out what would be the appropriate response given this challenge. Are there any incentives that you in future think about to encourage the manufacturing of machinery domestically? Secondly, it's the issue of tax payments. a substantial amount that we are paying to plant in Renard. Perhaps the DG, you know, one of our intentions in this committee, say that we have to negotiate this deal of something, and say that we should decide whether this is a development fund or so we can pay it or not. So I just want to find out how we're going to respond to this one. Lastly, my last question on behalf of Mr. Davis and the question that you just asked. I just want to find out on this issue of tax. In your view, what is the most appropriate action to undertake to incentivize business to invest? Is it depreciation allowance or tax cut for the main corporate tax?
Okay, I'm not going to allow you, Mr. Blood, to be asking questions on behalf of our commission.
Thank you very much. I'm referring to page 4, that the growth rate will rise to just over 5%. Now, if one looks at the growth rate, and the growth rate increased over time, and you compare it with the unemployment figure, I think it's a matter of concern. I just want to know from the minister whether he is satisfied that the budget gave enough attention to the supply side of the economy, specifically the private sector, to increase productivity for more job creation.
Okay.
Thank you.
So my question is on page 4 of the budget review. On the policy priorities, page 4 of the budget review on policy priorities. Can I ask this question in relation to the capacity of the department to spend, and also on the skills and shortage of skills, whether as you reprioritize or you put those as the main priority for the year or for this year, for this financial year. How much is intended to spend on these priorities, and whether we have the necessary skills to reach those of the objectives, taking into consideration all departments. My second key question here is on the next page, on the exchange rate. The first sentence there after volume is saying a more competitive exchange rate and strong commodity prices. And after now, indicating the capacities or indicating sectors that will perhaps, you know, be in our favor. My question is that we know that the exchange rate actually is determined by the market. And yet here you think that you need a more favorable exchange rate. What exchange rate are you looking at, and what do you think those variables make the exchange rate be in our favor?
Can we respond to those, and then of course on the next page we'll be checking the spots, Dr. Rami and Mr. Ray.
Thank you very much, Chair. Let me just indicate that in respect of the social security system, what we've opted to do to just decongest the information available is to release a more detailed paper tomorrow morning at a press conference in Johannesburg. I don't think this thing is worth
saying that the detailed paper which flows out of the process of discussion, and what in fact happened was, as work has been done on that paper, there has been engagement at various stages. The work actually
we got to understand that if you look at retirement funds to the exclusion of a whole gamut of issues, would actually not be advisable. So the issues of social security reform are all encompassing. Matters relating to the measure of poverty, referred to in the speech, and about which there was a paper about 10 or 12 pages. I think it was placed in the web yesterday. It was. So it's there. I mean, it's one element, because if you want to deal with the poverty trap, then you must be able to measure poverty. We haven't had a measure. We spoke about this over the past while. There's been considerable engagement. We've had some of the world's leading experts from a variety of institutions here to help us crack this problem. We think we have a method now going forward. It's one element. Another element is the reform just of the retirement fund industry and how it works. That's where we were the last time. That work has been taken largely in collaboration. The first draft was released, there was comment in the second draft, but then what we realized is that the conclusion of that process depended on the entirety of the changes in the fund. Now, before dealing with the specific question raised by Uncle Davidson, let me just say that, as indicated by both the President and I, what we want to clarify through this first phase, and this is now over the next few weeks, is the architecture. And use that for very detailed engagement with employers and the trade union. Now, I use the term employers, interchangeably with the notion of the private sector. If indeed you go to these tripartite arrangements in the ILO, employers is capital and there's labor, there's state. I mean, that very much is a triangle. Now, what we need to assess is whether we meet with fund managers, the life officers, or whether, in fact, a larger organization like Business Unity South Africa would be sufficiently encompassing to deal with that. We need to engage in order to fix that. And I think there similarly will be discussions with the trade unions, because I referred to the fact that one of the trade union leaders said to us, no, these aren't negotiations, this is a joint problem solving. It's a direct approach. So between now and the end of the year, we need to crack that, but we need an architecture and so on, so we can come back not just with our own views, but this committee and other committees of Parliament are going to be exceedingly important in understanding how to take these issues forward along. So that's the road we have to walk. Chapter 6 in the budget review is, of course, an entirely new chapter. It deals specifically with this. Some of the issues in Chapter 6 would previously have found their way into Chapter 7, but they would also have been in the fiscal policy chapter, Chapter 3. So, essentially, I suppose I'm saying there's been metamorphosis and a wider context that developed just as the work was proceeding. Now, within this context, I mean, one of the key issues is how people provide. The numbers are self-evident. too many people at the low. I mean, firstly, you start off with this terrible bifurcation. On the one hand, there are tax benefits for those who can afford RAs and so on. On the other hand, for lower income workers in South Africa, there is the reality of poverty. And it manifests itself partly by the ease of provident funds. Partly because of the notion of portability, yet too many workers cash out between jobs, leaving little behind. And the other problem is that there still is this terrible trade-off because of the application of the means test. So that if you, you know, you could be drawing a pension of 2,000 rand from your employer and find that the means test excludes you from receiving the 870 rand. It's a real poverty trap. The step down for working people into retirement is too large. So what we want to do is to smooth that. And the focus is largely on those kinds of issues. But it can't just be on retirement. The other benefits, including death and disability and so on, need to be taken account of, and you can only deal with it if at the same time you're also examining then the unemployment insurance fund. So the endeavor is to take those kinds of issues together. One of the difficulties that results in people ending up in that trap is that they are unrecorded workers. Even they are earning too little because they're below the tax threshold, which in terms of the proposal now before this committee, would shift to 43,000 rand. Or they might find themselves in that tax band, which still is at 60,000, so between 43 and 60. Or because employers deem these workers to be independent contractors and therefore not contributing to any. And this is the reality of the world of work for many people who have found their workspace casualized. Now, the question is the way subsidy to employers or employees is of course something that finds resonance in this place. I mean, let's cut to the chase. Part of what we'd like to see is the ease of employment and registration. So, you know, the broad approach, the table you refer to on page 113 is illustrative. We need to go and discuss these matters. But we have to start somewhere. The other route that we could have taken was to invite economists and actuaries and prepare a 1,000-page document and declare that it's here. But, you know, we want to get past the architecture allowing us to discuss this matter. I'm pretty sure, Chair, that we're going to have to come back to this committee time and again in the course of the year because the change is so large. I mean, I don't know why we wish this upon ourselves. The change is so large that we're going to have to engage, come back, steer. It's not party political, it's about changing the provisioning for all South Africans. And these are durable. If you do it wrongly, you end up in the traps where Western European finance ministries end up. If you go in the other direction, then you try and carve away what may already be vested in the rights of people. If you don't do it, you leave people in the poverty trap. So that's the approach that we have, and I'll ask for your indulgence to allow us to work through these issues. And we want to iterate with this committee on this process.
Yes, sorry.
It is employee, correct? One of the things that we've done, and this is why it's not something done outside of the work environment. Any employee earning within the time range is off our radar screen. Okay. No, because we've suspended the need for tax returns and therefore the need for individual records. And so part of what you need to reconstruct are records for all working people. This would bring us in line with the rest of the world. It's not a standalone. If we want to attain that, there are other reforms and administrative improvements that we have to bring, including business registration and so on. Parliament, over the course of the next few months, I think it may already be in the public domain, looks at the proposals for substantial reform to the Companies Act. What happens to what we now call CIPRA, the Companies and Intellectual Property Rights Office, become very important, because if it fails, then you can't get an accurate measure for revenue purposes, you can't then compile those lists. But then in SAT-SA, on the other hand, it doesn't work either, because it doesn't have an adequate sampling frame for the survey of earnings and employment. You know, these things are all working together. These are big administrative changes. But the direction is the employee. But it happens through the agency of the employer, because there's no other direct line. Now, the tango, Chairperson, between Lotto and David. You know, we have not announced, I want to start at a slightly different point. One of the debates that has taken place, and it was very deep, extensive, and somewhat protracted. How do we stimulate behavioral change? There was a time not too long ago when corporate rates were at 48%, they moved to 40, they now at 29. We need some way of measuring whether every time we reduce the rate, it produces the desired outcome. What is the desired outcome? The desired outcome, from our perspective, would be new investments in that which expands economic output and creates employment. Well, I think it's self-evident for that. But the key question to resolve is whether it has the desired outcome. Now, beyond a particular point, some of these tax measures no longer work in and of themselves. If you drop the rate 2%, 4%, 10%, what stimulates change? What says to executives, well, what government is not doing is merely asking you to take more out of this company as remunerative benefits? What is it? Because at a certain point, the bluntness of the instrument results in outcomes that could not have been anticipated. It's that kind of problem that's due. Now, for some reason, though we explained at length the origin and intent of the what has been called the secondary tax company, some people have chosen to add it to the corporate rate, which it never been. Because the construct is entirely different. The construct is entirely different. And so, how much further do you move this rate? Because you really are in the same zone with your competitors. And if you want the desirable outcomes, shouldn't you now be looking at the sharp rates? That's the question. And we've not been in a position to announce a long list of incentives for this and that. Not even in categories. A few years ago, we introduced what is called the strategic investment package. We're not even there. But we know that we must change behavior, and so that's the debate that we're involved with. And this flows out of the debate of industrial policy. We're getting a lot of framework. But, and the president said that Atmul also now raised the fact of machinery. Some of these issues are going to be very difficult. Partly because it's very hard to pick up capacity where it's been destroyed. Let me mention an example. They used to, at a factory near Germiston, make the wheels and bogies for rolling stock. But demand dropped off, and then they shut the factory and they import some parts from China and some parts from Germany, and they put these things together. Now, can you really get those forges up and running again? There need to be all kinds of questions. Has the technology changed to the extent where the old methods that we used when these factories were viable in South Africa, do they still find resonance in a world that's globalized as such? There are going to be a series of questions about how you take these issues forward, where economies of scale work, where economies of scope work. But we'd like to give this committee the assurance that from our side in the ministry, I mean, though we're not close to ideas, we're going to have to apply some pretty rigorous tests. Partly because, people in the private sector come up with some woolly ideas sometimes. And so it's just what we're going to have to do. I'm not saying we closed, but we're going to have to do that. The capacity constraints, yes, they're there in government. They're also there, as you point out, in the private sector. One of the points we were raising yesterday is you can look at every bid for the construction of a stadium in 2010, and I don't know that there was any instance that there were more than 5 contractors in the bid. And in some, I mean, others walked away and there were 2 left. Now, I would imagine the construction of stadiums is a not too difficult issue. Unless you have a very complex stadium, because those who are undertaking the construction of Wembley Stadium in the UK haven't yet completed the job and they've been in court I don't know how many times. So we're not going to be unique in this. I said in this committee before that you can open newspapers in the United States any day of the week, you'll read about the shortage of civil engineers and project managers. And if you look at the Gulf States, if you look at how they're investing in infrastructure, and you take the profitability of South African construction firms in that part of the world, I mean, it's very hard to persuade them that they should be nationalist about where they're going to construct. All of this is part of the difficulty. And then, of course, the demand for inputs, building materials, and so on and so on. These things are going to dominate. They're going to dominate, they're going to impact the prices, and they happen alongside the other capacity issues that we have to deal with. To the other. On the issue of cycle payments, Chair, at a cycle meeting in early December in Windhoek, we gave verbal notice, and subsequently we've given written notice that we will seek, as we're entitled to do in terms of the agreement, we will seek the amendment in form. We've not made any subsequent submissions to this matter, but you know we've acted in the spirit of the way in which the matter is raised here. What was the other question? Stimulation of business. I can't read my answer. Stimulation of business. What? That will come back. No, but that one I dealt with because if not, then we can come back to it. I mean, the question by Dr. Gift on growth and unemployment. I mean, first point to make is that the rate of employment is now faster than the number of schools, even 500,000. The second point, I think, is that we have this enormous challenge of people, and I'd say under the age of 45, who've been unemployed for too long and frequently don't have the requisite skills even to become autonomous. So it's a large tragedy that confronts us. In respect of the changes in the period ahead, I mean, they're measurable. Further education training, and firstly to get people into FET. Money for chairs in universities to improve on the number of scientists, technologists, engineers, stakeholders. Changes to education, change the output, focus on teacher bursaries. I think we'd like to see math and science and all of those things. There's clearly a plan going forward, but the big challenge is dealing with the large numbers of people who are still young and probably still have 20 to 30 years of working life left who haven't been. That's a big challenge, and that's where the skills mismatch confronts us strongly. There's no easy route to this, and I think that in the examination of supply side measures, it's very hard, and I'm not sort of wringing my hands and lamenting the fact that there's this reality that exists. And I think that all that we do, I suppose, at the end of the day, is we take views from our colleagues, and we prepare a budget. Despite our individual passions, we're not responsible for the implementation of various line functions, but it's something we can come back to. DG, do you want to respond to the rest, any of those that I've missed out? Because there's a whole chunk of questions that Honorable Mugudi raised.
I think that your part is that I love this question of the skills capacity and then the other one being the exchange rate and competitiveness. I don't know why after we can talk more about the exchange. It is now this year it will be sometime later this year, it would be 11 years since GIA was adopted. Anyone who goes and reads in GIA, GIA talks about a competitive and stable exchange rate. So it's not like a big scientific discovery that people are now talking that we must have a competitive exchange rate. It been there. The problem is, people are so obsessed talking about the nominal exchange rate. So people look and say, today the rand dollar is this, therefore the currency is 2 weak. Today the rand dollar is this, therefore the currency is 2 strong. You cannot impact on real variables by trying to manipulate your nominal variables. That's not good work. You are talking about competitiveness here, you've got to look at the real effective exchange rate. That is what impacts on competitiveness. If we look back last year, we actually established that the rent in real terms on a trade weighted basis has actually reached by between 10 and 15%, depending which month you pick at the beginning of the So, Ms. Mguni, in the context of where you were raising the issue, I had looked at the statement there. What the statement actually says is, because you have got a competitive exchange rate now, it should help you to moderate the current account deficit and so forth. And you are right. Because the other lens that you are talking about, the one that everybody gets worried about, the one that every ordinary South African sees, the nominal exchange rate, it is determined out there in the market on a daily basis, on a minute-by-minute basis. It's influenced by the movement in capital flows. It's influenced by developments that take place elsewhere in the global economy.
That's and the one that results in being reported. The rand fell precipitously from 7.14 to 7.17 in overnight trade.
So that is the one that everybody. that is what everybody actually keep on looking at. Now, you have a political choice. You can decide like the other country that has got a reserve of $1 trillion that you will fix your exchange rate and live with the consequences of fixing the exchange rate now. $1 trillion of reserve? I don't know what the cost of holding those reserves are if they are not $1 trillion. Or you could go on and look at the history of other countries that fight to peg their currency. Hong Kong peg, the Thailand peg, the Argentinian peg, and so forth. When you try to fix exchange rate, you are basically saying, trying to put into the mind of bureaucrats a notion that they know what the real value of the exchange rate is. And I can tell you now, if anybody knows what they are doing, anybody who knows that what the exchange rate of the current of the rent should be, they can fix the number. And let me tell you now, those people who move capital and understand what value is, they will take you on. They will take you on. And let us not forget the history that we have in this country where we tried to defend the level of a nominal exchange rate before. And the billions of rand that we wasted when we built a net open forward position trying to get some currency. It's a consequence you want to live with. But I can tell you now, it's very expensive. So We are from there. I don't think that this is an option, a policy option. The choice that we have made as a country is that we are going for a floating exchange rate. Floating exchange rate, yes, if we need to, if there are shocks, maybe external shocks, it would mean that it becomes painful. But at the same time, it means that the exchange rate also plays a role as a shock absorber for the economy. Now, the key policy challenge then that faces you is, how do you mitigate against this risk? And there are lots of policy options. Having a solid macro framework is one. We have it, we know that. But on its own, it is not adequate. Could go on and build reserves. We previously had negative reserves. The Reserve Bank has done a salad of building reserves. And for those who think that the reserves have risen from 0 to $25 billion, actually, the reserves have risen by $50 billion because we moved from a negative position of $25 billion to a positive position of $25 billion. So the turnaround has been a remarkable one. The third type of issues would have to do with dealing with your external vulnerability, because you need to ask yourself, how vagarable are you to the vagaries of global finance? One thing that the governor of the Central Bank of Egypt economy said was, let's ask ourselves a simple test. If you are shut out of international capital markets for 1 year, can you survive? Somebody has asked that test many times. Even when we were not shut up, we decided we will not go in there because we don't like the crisis that we see there. Now, you have a capital account, it introduces risk for your macro position. You've got to take a stance that mitigates against that. You have a fiscal position that is beginning to do that. You're building reserves that is reducing your external vulnerability indicator. That's about what you could do. There isn't much you can do in terms of manipulation of exchange rates because these levels are decided elsewhere, and you and I do not have much control.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. You are still protected,
DG. You are still protected. Thank you, sir. You are protecting me. You are asking me whether I am still on the campus.
Chair, I know that you have a speaking engagement. Here where they're being their own world side at 6 o'clock. And we listed that speaking event slide, he's not going to make that speaking video. So I'm really advising him to that's all I'm saying.
I'm back.
Okay. You were mitigating against the current account
deficit.
Okay, if you are done, are there any questions that we haven't dealt with in the first batch? If not, let's quickly move on to the next one, because as Ben indicated, we would want to release the commissioner, the minister, and what they have dealt with as part of the in our next batch, it was Ms. Fox, Dr. Rabi, and Ms. Marek.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you very much, Minister and the National Treasury team and so on. Through you, Chair, perhaps point that one would like clarified and so on. On the one hand, in the budget review and certainly again in the presentation, the point is made about the increase in imports and the very valid, justifiable and welcome increase in infrastructure expenditure and so on. But as we too know, the two are in fact linked. And linked to that, they are also linked, of course, to the current account deficit. Now I know the point has been made that the exports will be used as a driver, or, you know, to a downward pressure driver on the deficit in that current account. But what one would like to know is how you see this balancing out given the increased global situation on the commodity price. That's the first one. The second one is certainly it's extremely welcome, this Texas social pillar to address the poverty. But what worries one is the, with respect to even the looting of the poverty line, research and so on, is the continuing effect that transport itself, in order for the poor to obtain jobs, to seek opportunity, is never taken into account. So you've got the development of infrastructure, but the cost of the use of that infrastructure is often so prohibitive that no amount of social increase is able to assist the poor in actually seeking employment itself because of the high cost of transport. The final point I'd like to make, Chairperson, is one of the comments I heard this morning as I drove to work. I think the minister was being interviewed on SAFM, and I'd just like a closer understanding of this loose money. I know we do have a considerable amount of money available for expenditure, and I know that certainly from the JDC side, we're very concerned that there should be any further under-expenditure, particularly where there are increases to allocation. But I think you yourself said again this morning, there is a danger when there is, and I think I'm right when I heard you saying loose money, there would be an element of loose money. And certainly whenever there is loose money, it becomes even more important to monitor the expenditure of the allocation. Thank you.
Okay. Temporal response. The stuff that you said in radio interviews is very different from what you said before the committee. Dr. Rabi?
Thank you, Chair. Chair, it's not only the Minister and the Commissioner which is in a hurry. I've got another meeting at 2 o'clock, but my question is to the Commissioner of Revenue, Ms. Gordon. On page 19 of the submission, you mentioned that 1.3 billion is provided for SARS for core systems and upgrade of customs scanners. About a year or 2 years ago, I asked the question to the Honourable Minister, how many South Africans pay taxes? And I think the question was between 4 and 5 million actually pay income tax and so forth. My question to you, Mr. Gordon, how many potential taxpayers are still out of the tax net? Is it possible to finish us with an estimate? And then the second thing is the customs scanners. Are the present ones working effectively, or do you suspect that we lose a fair amount of revenue regarding illegal imports? I read some that some textile manufacturers allege that a number of some textiles are imported into this country, which is not paying, they're not paying taxes upon them. And then the third question is how effective is the tax amnesty for small business? Are you making good progress? Thank you. Chair.
Okay.
Lawrence. Thank you very much, Chair. Just to the Minister, following on your the news with regards to the money allocated for the FIFA World Cup. Now, I know that next year is Paralympics and the Olympic Games, and there's a Team South Africa that must be presented also to the All Africa Games. And I stand to be corrected, but I think there's some expectations with SASCOC about allocations from government to SASCOC for that purpose. I've tried to look in the document. SASCOC was mentioned, but I couldn't pick up anything that was specifically allocated for that purpose. I'm not sure whether you can give me that answer now, but for more medals for South Africa, I think that will be quite important. Thank you very much.
Okay, so what are the...
I didn't hear the member's name.
It is Mr. Murray. Mr. Mbuno, do you have a follow-up? Because if it's not, am I going to suppress it? Or is it a very small one? It's just short.
Yeah, I
Yes, yes, yes. Now, I ask the question because the Treasury seems also to be concerned about the competitiveness of the currency. Even the President said that the currency was overvalued. That's why I was asking the question whether, what is the Treasury's view of the competitive currency? So, if
you were contextualizing your previous question. Oh, okay. You'll have just answered yourself in being able to be relieved in your response.
Yes. I will engage on Mooney to check where the president says the currency is over there. I mean, the president is very precise in his language.
I also would not want you to respond on the State of the Nation address if it came up there, because this is about the money.
No, because it didn't come up in the State of the Nation address. But we'll engage in that issue. Chair, let me, South Africa last year imported something in the order of 462 billion rands worth of goods. Top of the list was machinery at 121, followed by transport at about 54, that includes motor vehicles, mineral products including oil 89, equipment 15, chemical product 38, and so on. These are inputs. So, sometimes you find that these classifications don't work because you follow the international standard classification. So in equipment you may find that it includes iPods and so on and so on, and the actual consumer goods. But in general terms, I think that we tend to get very flustered about the issue of imports without appreciating what contribution the imports will make to future growth, A, and B, the trends in the global economy in respect of these huge imbalances. I mentioned in the speech yesterday, I cited two examples, but you could take many, many countries' examples of the huge swings between countries in surplus and countries in deficit. So, you know, of course we've got to continue to raise these matters, but we raise them for rational discussion and not because we think that the next thing to do is dress in sackcloth and ashes. The issue of transport is actually part of a wider problem, and something that we can be mindful of in the job we do. The problem is, before you can get into a train or taxi to go look for work, you must know where to go. And one of the issues that impact on us is that there are huge information asymmetries. And that's what you've got to correct, and a part of it is engaging the Department of Labor, ensuring that the information is available at multipurpose community centers and so on. Because the trend in many economies is that frequently people know where to look. They might refuse the job and therefore seed payments from some insurance scheme, but they know where to look. It's that difficulty that we have to bridge, and it's only when you know where to look and you decide that you're not going to aimlessly spend days or weeks commuting in a taxi somewhere that you can actually deal with for sure. It's that. Okay. The Chair, I can't do the work of Parliament. I mean, you don't quite know what's on, but in respect of the other two departments that report into this committee at least, there will be a publication in terms of Section 32 of the PMMA for January tomorrow. Next week, early next week, somewhere. And when the committee sees the Gazette, does it say to the DG who's run away to catch his plane, please, could you explain, 10 months of the year have elapsed, you've only spent 50% of the money on this. Can we take a straight line extrapolation to year end, and will you cede the following amount back to Treasury? That's the power that the PMMA gives Parliament. And it will be uniform across all departments. If there's just cause, if it can be explained why that money's not being spent, then yes. If not, then if Parliament fails and the Treasury has only spent 50% of a particular program's money, and it says, hey, we don't want to lose this money, so next year in the evaluations, let's make it look like we've spent a lot, then you've got very loose money at the end of the fiscal year. It's called the hockey stick. And you get these spikes right at the end of the fiscal year. And I think that every time a spike happens, it happens because Parliament isn't doing its work. So I will campaign, motivate, stir up trouble. I will be unpopular with my colleagues, but I will agitate Parliament to exercise its responsibility. Thank you.
Chairperson, Dr. Rabi's question. Our current register will probably look something like this. I don't have the exact figures here, but individuals would be about 5.5 million. Companies, effectively about 1 million, but nominally about 1.5 million. Back vendors, about 600,000. KYE, self-employers, about 350,000. And depending on which type of taxpayer we are looking at, there could be 5 to 10% factor in terms of people that we might want to draw in. But remember also that on a year-on-year basis, our register has been growing in total of 10% each year. So we are growing the register faster than the economy, so to speak. So we are drawing in new people into our ranks. In terms of the amnesty, our current application is at about 13,000. And the minister and ourselves will be beating that down a little faster. Hopefully, join us in that. There is that human tendency of leaving things to the last minute, so we are making some statements to that effect. But you will see an intensive case on the other in the next couple of weeks. On the Canada's question, the tender was put out last year. It's being processed at the moment, and within the next 3 months to have a new set of standards on the ground. At the moment, we only have one standard, and it's fairly low, and that's the standard in force. There are always going to be some elements of import that will be slipping through our fingers, as you know. We examine between 3 and 5% of the containers in one form or another, and that's the international norm. And until we get both standards and more technical profiling systems, there will be an element of slippage. But we have other mechanisms in place as well, like post clearance orders, which help us to reinforce the control processes even after containers have left our hands, so to speak. And the 1.3 billion grant is to ensure that over the next 3 years, some issues that the minister has been referring to are taken care of, which include an upgrading of our
Chair, let me deal with the Honourable Maria question by saying, I really don't know. I mean, the way in which the estimate of national expenditure put together is that we draw a template in the Treasury, we start with allocation letters, we draw a template in the Treasury, we distribute it to all departments, they have to then explain the program, explain the measurable objectives, and submit it. It won't be published until there's a signature by the Director General. So that chapter 18 of the MD of this estimate of national expenditure deals with votes. 18, which is sport and recreation, is owned by the DG of the department. I'd like to help, but I really don't know. I can see part of money that went to Sadcock. I can see lots of the 2010 FIFA World Cup. I can see the map participation stuff, but I really can't see. And I think it's a justifiable question. Perhaps the other committee must ask when they're not selected.
Okay, thank you very much.
Minister, your attention. For your information, departments are becoming smarter by having their hockey sticks in December rather than March. We have started to become smarter now.
Take them out in November.
Yeah, well, thank you very much for the limited time that we had, and I trust that members have got answers to their questions. And we look forward to the process that you have spoken about of portfolio committees that include ourselves in ensuring that whatever is in the estimate of national expenditure and strategic plans, departments live up to that, and money is being spent, but not only being spent, but the quality of the spending is something that we're proud of. Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Minister. You are the least. We are now going to immediately move on to the FFC to take a presentation on their comments to the Division of Revenue Bill, and after that, take a quick human rights break after that, not now. And then I would like to urge committee members to please stay the course, because at the end of the process we're going to need a full quorum in order to be able to formally consider the Division of Revenue passage and send it to the National Council of Provinces. And the FFC. Thank you very much, Commissioner and the Minister.
Funds that
allocated to a province, and then the money doesn't move or may not move, and then we recommended that it should be transferred maybe to somebody or another province where money is moving. This, there's been acceptance all around, even on the part of government. But just that there have been unintended effects, I think we'll address those unintended consequences in other ways. And then on the issue of aggregation of municipalities, that's another point that we are highlighting or observing. We first made a recommendation on that in 2004, and it is a clause in the DOR that we feel ought to continue and be kept. But however, that being the case for my initial remarks, I will ask my colleague Jaya to take over from here, maybe highlight a few points, and then pass on for presentation to Tanya.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, honorable members, I go very quickly through this presentation. We did circulate our formal submission, which you should have in your pack, and the chairperson of the commission, Dr. Petro Tsutai, and Commissioner Tanya Jam, and I will focus on much of the presentation. The submission that we go through is basically in terms of Chapter 13 of the Constitution and the IDFR Act in Sections 2141 and 2, A to J of the Constitution. Section 220 of the Constitution requires that the FSC take account of some of those considerations. Key areas that we look at is the equitability of the shares and other considerations, including, as my chairperson has indicated, the macroeconomic considerations and other concerns of development and efficiency, etc. We do have consultations with National Treasury in terms of the IGFR Act. We should meet with them, with the minister at least 14 days before he presents the budget. We have met with the minister and the Budget Council and National Treasury on an ongoing basis throughout the year, so much has been discussed already. And during the budget process, we also have several discussions with the ministry and with National Treasury. So I won't go into much detail on the two issues. The chairperson of the commission has raised that. Suffice to say that the FSC would like now that we reconsider this whole process of reallocation of funds, not so much because there are problems or that we want to take back the recommendation we made in 2004, but essentially we feel that there needs to be some formalization of agreement between the different parties and National Treasury, and there must be some tightening of any agreement for reallocation of the funds. Because we will be, if we don't do that, we are undermining the whole budget process and the transparency and the credibility and the possibilities of Treasury planning from the different provinces. So we feel that there definitely needs to be a review undertaken on how reallocation is going to be, continue if funds are not spent. The other point of our general concern was the whole issue about crediting municipalities to fast-track and to the delivery in housing. We reiterate that this process of accreditation should be speeded up. The National Department of Housing must take cognizance of the problems and work towards accrediting municipalities that have the capacity so that housing delivery can move ahead. The chair of the commission has gone through some of the submissions that we've dealt with in the past, and we are one of the key areas that we focused on was the conditional grant, and National Treasury and government in general have accepted many of the issues that the FSC has raised in its submission documents. The two key principles of the conditional grant that we maintain and we argue that should remain is that grants should be used to deal with spillovers. and to fund new priorities, and these should be eventually institutionalized within the system and in the subnational budget process. We also argue that norms and standards must be defined in areas where there's concurrent responsibilities, so that the services may be monitored and compliance may be met. There are several grants within the process have been discussed, and government is considering many of these grants. I won't go through these in great detail. Suffice to say that there's been much agreement between the SOC and government. There have been areas of disagreement, and some of this we highlight in the submission. In particular, the areas around the hospital revitalization grant. Government is going to look at this area, and we are waiting patiently for government findings on this. On the area of land care and comprehensive agricultural support grants, government is of the view that these serve different objectives, so they don't agree with us that these can be merged. But the Commission's main concern in this regard was that the administrative burden was a bit too heavy for the people receiving these grants. The other area of contention was the school nutrition program grant. Government is reviewing this grant, and the Commission will make further recommendations, which we will submit for the 2008 division of revenue. On the issue of the municipal infrastructure grant, we have a difference on this issue. Government is of the view that the municipalities should fund the operations and maintenance costs. We raise concerns on specifically for the municipalities that don't have the capacity and don't have the funds and cannot raise their own revenues. And in that case, as we all aware, municipal infrastructure tends to deteriorate, and if there's no funds for operation and maintenance, that may create serious problems. The other area of contention was on the issue of HIV and AIDS and livelihood education. Government is of the view that in the long term, this grant will be phased in into the equitable share formula. We support this, and we say it's consistent with our recommendations, but we feel that we should speed up the process of integrating this within the budget process. For the health professionals grant, government highlights the challenges associated with implementing the Commission's recommendations. We appreciate these challenges and we continue working further on trying to look at what the problems may be. The human settlement development grant is another area of contention. Government does not agree that we could cater for the regional costs. We note government's response, but we also observe that while there may be problems and the formula may be complicated, but we do know that the original provincial equitable share formula does have a ruralness weighting factor in it, which is used to take account of some variation. And the practice internationally is that variation for location, geographic conditions, and other socioeconomic conditions can be taken into account. And we feel that maybe more thought and reflection should be given to this. That's on the issues of the submission that we made and the differences in government's response to what we are saying. But overall, the response is very positive. And I think that we feel that we can work closely in trying to do more work and work in cooperation with government on this. On the issue of the macroeconomic concerns which underlie the division of revenue bill, which I think is a key concern of this committee, especially the portfolio committee. I won't go on to the basis of what the DG has spoken about earlier on, because we've covered that and we think that it's fairly clear. The issue of the forecast is a key area that we have been concerned about, not so much that it doesn't give us the correct basis. We, in fact, applaud government's very sound macroeconomic positions. Our concern, Chair, is we think, at the risk of sounding like we are nitpicking, I think we feel that some of the forecasts have tended to create the impression, especially for example on the revenue side and some of the others, create the impression that there has not been much verification of the forecast. So we would like to see eventually, as the practice internationally, that there be some authoritative verification of how the forecast arrived at, and so that it will lend a lot more credibility to the forecast that are being presented. On the issue of the tax GDP ratio, we know that starting with the GEAR articulation in GEAR, 25% was used, but as we know, currently it's about 28.5, and this always raises the concern again on the credibility gap that a higher forecast, a higher ratio sort of implies a heavier tax burden, which may not be the case. And we feel that some consideration should be given to reviewing this benchmark and perhaps look at a range of some parameters within which forecast may be presented for the GDP tax ratio. I've talked about the issue of the budget surplus, and budget surplus policy, clearly we've been through it with the VP of National Treasury, and I think he's talked extensively on that. But we think that what we perhaps need here and what we'd like to advocate is that perhaps a strategy that constantly evaluates the alternatives for what we can use the surpluses and what criteria of efficiency may be implemented. Chair, one of the key areas or two of the key areas that we were looking at was the whole principle of borrowing, especially for the mega projects and the Gauteng railway. Is one key area here. Currently, we don't see a danger, we don't see a risk, and it's essentially because of the surpluses that have been generated. But we think that under the current practice, the Borrowing Powers Act that provinces can use, or other legislation which makes it possible for provinces to actually, or for national government to borrow on behalf of provinces. There's no fear at this stage that this may be unsustainable, but essentially what that means is that the burden of servicing the debt then falls on national government. And in the context of the national interest and the servicing of the national debt, I think we need to be aware of what the risk may be. But another key area is that one province sets a precedent of borrowing on this basis, the risk for high debt burden may escalate if the precedent is set and other provinces also want to use the same argument. There is a huge commitment on the 2010 FIFA World Cup. The conditional grant and part of the equitable share that has been used. The FSC's concern here is whether these allocations may crowd out the constitutionally mandated basic services, and while we don't think that may be a risk at this stage, but we would like to warn of the possibility that that may happen. Of particular concern for us in this respect is that the funding of the legacy effect, once the World Cup has come and gone, and we are sitting with infrastructure that may require permanent or sustainable maintenance and operational costs, we think there needs to be some clarification of those issues. Chair, the final section here I'll hand over to my colleague Commissioner Tanya Jam, who will take us through some of the areas of concern on the allocation.
Chair, I'd like to please refer you to page 23 of the green document. This shows the table that I will be speaking to. I know that there are some of myself including, so visually challenged and prefer to have things close up. What I've been looking at is a rather high-level analysis of the 2007 Division of Revenue Provincial Allocations, which I think is quite appropriate given our time constraints, but also given the fact that the FSC will be engaging with committee on specific sectoral performance issues relative to priorities and specific sector analysis on expenditure and revenue trends. So when considering AGISA, GIPSA, and other important policy priorities, these focus attention on capital infrastructure investment as well as investment in training and personnel. If one looks at the growth in provincial budgets over the MPF period, the average growth rate is 4.13%. If we look at these specific priority areas, we see that capital investment increases at 5.46%, training at 7.35%, and personnel expenditure at 2.29%. Okay, so this gives us some indication that capital and infrastructure investment is being prioritized, as well as training expenditure, although training expenditure starts off at quite a low base, only constituting 0.8% of total provincial government expenditure. As Lisa and the World Cup, as the Minister referred to, and my colleague from the Commission earlier, also emphasizes infrastructure services, and for provinces, this is manifested in their budget for transport, housing, and agriculture. When one considers transport expenditures, these appear to be no longer prioritized in the expenditure, despite rapid growth in spending absorption and very low underspending for provincial departments. This indicator is derived from a drop in the growth rate from 11.2% actual expenditure over the last MTF period to 2.1% over this MTF period. When looking at housing, the real housing growth rate, 9.3%, which is a substantial increase after 3 years of stagnation in the previous MTF period. Looking at the agriculture growth rate, we see that this growth rate continues to exceed the provincial average, but has been halved to 4.31% per annum. We also note various areas of volatility in infrastructure budgets and spending, which hampers effective planning and delivery. So we see cycles of policy prioritization, over budgeting, then underspending and decreasing allocations, and this undermines a predictable planning environment. Looking at provincial social services, education and health budgets constitute 70% of provincial budgets, but are personnel intensive and exhibit more stable growth paths. We see in the new budget that the initiatives to enhance remuneration to specific specialized skill in those areas, and both education and health expenditures could grow at below average rates over the MTF period and contribute to keeping spending below the revenue growth. When looking at premier's offices and provincial legislatures, their expenditure growth rate in real terms of the MTF period is said to be negligible, whereas in the past they grew at 7% and 13.7% respectively. And then finally, just to note my earlier comments, that more details on departmental policy performance against priorities, spending against budget, performance and more analysis of service delivery data will be discussed by the Commission in its engagement with Select Committee during its hearings process. I hand over to the Chair.
Yeah, thanks FFC. Let's take, but to the Chair of FFC.
Thank you, Chair. I think maybe, at this stage, I think at this stage we can look forward to questions, any points of clarification. I would just like to say that the whole team may assist each other with.
Okay, thank you. Members, questions? Dr. Van Dijk, Ms. Dambuza, Ms. Dangoli. The others. Let's start with Dr. Van Dijk.
Chairperson, thank you very much. I refer to page 7 of the presentation of the Green Document. The municipal infrastructure grant, it intent that the Commission recommended that the formula should be reviewed to assist municipalities also as far as the maintenance of infrastructure concerns, if I understand that is correct. Now, we also know that the Auditor General a while ago referred to transfers extra money from national for basic free services. Some of this money was due for salary increases and bonuses. What measures are in place if we do change this formula to make sure that the money will be utilized effectively? What is in place to monitor and to control the whole process? Thank you.
Thank you, Dr.
Sanjay
Sheikh. I said the next one is Ms. Amguni. Oh, Ms. Amguni, sorry.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Mine is around the submissions that have been forwarded by FSC on the issue of accreditation of municipalities. I would like to know if have they observed that there are challenges that are being encountered by the municipalities, more especially the capacity. Although we have agreed, I think most of us do have the same opinion that this process must be fast-tracked. But I think as we have been interacting with the municipalities, we have also observed that there are so many challenges, more especially on the, around the issue of responsibilities that are supposed to be performed by those respective municipalities. There's a misinterpretation somewhere, somehow. So I just wanted to check from FSC if they've also observed that. Because to me, we're all interested that this process must be started, but we also need to ensure that we cherish all the issues that are going to be problematic in the near future. And the other question, it's not a question as such, Chairperson, but I would like the FSC if they can share with us what are the recommendations that they have sent to the National Treasury, more especially on this National Schools Nutrition Program, because it is also a problem that is observed nationally. So if they can share that with us. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Ms. Ambusa. Ms. Amguni?
Thanks, Chair. My question is on a statement on page 19 of the document on macroeconomics. I just want to find out how feasible it is that you can have an institution or an institutionalized entity that will comment or that verify assumptions of one economy to the other. Just what the teacher. I find it a bit strange that you can verify assumptions because the assumptions are based on many variables that can be, there can be another institution that can verify assumptions.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Bamji. Your mic. Mr. Bamji, will you please switch off that one and switch on the one in front of you?
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. In the world of grants, unconditional grants, etc. Now, in a final analysis, in terms of value for money, who do you hold accountable? And who ought to be held accountable? In other words, if the department, for example, if Treasury is giving certain conditional grants, is in a final analysis Treasury accountable for those grants?
itself is given some grant? Is it health itself? Or is it the local government or the provincial government or who ought to account for those grants? And from your perspective, how do you monitor that? The second point is that the minister in his speech also talked about forensic being updated, etc., pathology investigation. And I also saw a chance to see forensic pathology service grant that goes under health work for steam. I just want to know that there's an indication there, who talks to who, listen, I recall, that about fingerprinting. And also, I'm not sure the DNA sort of process that would take place to have enough information to ensure that the grant statistics are meaningfully addressed. Now my question is Home Affairs talking to the police services? Because in terms of determining the fingerprint, if it is not on the police data, you can't go to Home Affairs for them to verify the fingerprint if it was seen at the scene of the crime. Because then you're talking about violating of the Constitution, the rights enshrined in the Constitution. I just want to know whether we've been asking a lot of money determining the fingerprint process, etc., just to find that Home Affairs will say, no, you cannot dig any further because you are now violating the Constitution. I'm not sure if I'm clear, but if I'm right, gentlemen, talking about it over again. I'm trying to say, are the departments talking to each other? And you are talking about giving conditional grants, and then they may be just putting money in, but no results at the end of the day because you think the constitutional comes into play and prevents us from determining exactly who was on the scene of the crime. Because you can only look at the police data and not much more. You cannot go into the Home Affairs file to establish really whether that fingerprint is one that belongs to a criminal or a potential criminal.
Yeah, thank you, Honorable Member. Mr. Beatley.
Thank you, Chair. I've got two questions. Not to practice just one question, but it's going to refer to two sections of the on page 6 of the Green Document. What motivated you to think of making submissions regarding the land care and CASP? And the second one, regarding the National School Nutrition. What motivated you to want to have change of those? Thanks.
Yeah. Thank you, Member. I've also... I hope... Should I take the next person? Are you still okay? Yeah, let me take Ms. Mokoto.
Thanks, Professor. I want to field a question to FFC regarding the budgeting system. I want to check to what extent are you intervening in the total alleviation of silo operations between provinces and municipalities, which largely affects the efficiency and proper coordination of our government programs. This I ask in view of the fact that IDPs and budgets for the provinces are still not connected, and they have an impact in the capacity that we have in the municipality and to the efficiency of program implementation. I want your view on that. Thanks.
Thank you, FFC. You may respond.
Thank you, Chair. I'll ask some of my colleagues to assist with some of these issues. With respect to the monitoring of the municipal infrastructure grant in place. There are conditions there, and departments or the allocations have specific conditions, and some of those conditions include monitoring, but I'd ask Mongani to go into greater detail on that. With the issue of accreditation, yes, we've observed challenges, and we are aware that there are serious problems associated with accreditation. Currently, we don't have a clear indication of how many municipalities have been accredited, and if they have been, what the issues are. But we do think that the process, because the intergovernmental fiscal relations system is fraught with a whole range of complications, especially when it comes to the concurrent functions and so on, and the coordination between these functions, we feel that the accreditation principle of accreditation is a very sound principle, but we need to address those challenges, and we need to look at capacity, especially for those municipalities and so on. But I believe National Treasury is in discussion with the Department of Housing to be able to address some of those issues. On the issue of the nutrition program, in our submission last year, the recommendation was that the conditions that relate to the nutrition program for the development and approval of business plans must be refined to take into account the following. We address minimal time that is spent on the process of developing an approving plan, because the current conditions make it very onerous on the communities and the schools to produce those plans. The second issue we highlight is that the delay in submission of the plan and the plans and the excessive non-compliance by provinces. There is lots of delays when the plans go through and it doesn't get implemented. The third issue is that the FSC recommendation proposed relaxing some of the stringent conditions, because some of the conditions for some of the school nutrition program coordination processes is too strict and too difficult for some of these. So we suggested that there should be some relaxing around those issues. But the document is available if you want to go to one. So why do you want to take some of the arguments?
What I can respond to is firstly the issue around the municipal infrastructure grant and it's being used for salaries. Basically, being in that case, it should be being used for a purpose other than the transfer is made. And I think there is the Municipal Finance Management Act would be the first port of call to deal with those kinds of issues. So there's legislation. I don't think that the FSC would actually have anything much to say about what happened, except to highlight that kind of a thing is happening and it's not actually consistent with what the plan is designed for. With respect to the school nutrition, National School Nutrition Program, just to expand a little bit on what Jai has already said, the issue really is not that there's a difference between National Treasury and ourselves, or government and ourselves, but that there is a broader review that is being undertaken around that grant. The reason why we undertook to review it is just it was just that the motivation was that it was part of those grants that we thought were grants that actually, in terms of the principles that the Commission has always advocated for with respect to the use of conditional grants, it's one of the grants that fits in that category of grants where we say that there are these programs that you would ideally want to see being assimilated in the provincial education budget process. They are key national priorities that one needs to address, and so you want to encourage provincial education departments to take them into account, so you establish a conditional grant so that that becomes part and parcel of the process. But there were problems that were put across by specifically the Select Committee of Finance to the Commission around the implementation of the grant itself in its current format. And they requested us to do a little bit more work in terms of whether it could be extended to beyond
primary school. It should be intended to cover all school going children that actually at the level. So we've been doing a bit more work, which will then fit into whatever the final outcomes from the from government's own work is. The issue around the value for money with respect to conditional grants and who do you hold accountable for that, I think the Honorable MP has actually got it right, that the conditional grant belongs to the National Department. So the National Department uses the conditional grant to achieve certain objectives. Now, whether they are using a province to do that or they are using a municipality to do that, they still have the responsibility to ensure that the objective for that grant is actually, I would assume that the accountability should lie with the National Department primarily, but the National Department should then deal with the accountability issues between itself and the provincial or the local government that's dealing. I think those are the
Chair, on the issue you want to...
The question was asked on a very fine authority. We thought that we spread this idea of a very fine authority simply because it is important to understand the assumptions on which our projections are based. There must be an authoritative body that will sort of keep after what the treasury is, because we are working on the treasury models now and then other informal people. But somebody must be a center someone who will say you are based on an assumption that is wrong or that is not wrong. For example, somebody might say our economy is like that of Argentina. Therefore we must plan according to how Argentina plans. And only to find that in fact our economies are basically completely different. And that means they say we have to develop our own assumptions on which we base our projections. So it is really that point, that as we project forward our economy, we must really ensure that we are on solid ground. So the idea is to plan it, but then as an ongoing process, we may come up with some position documents and then later some appropriate organization or appropriate entity might be formed to do that work. Or instead South Africa might get the assignment. Anybody can get the assignment, but it's important that that person can be in the So really the idea was to say.
Thank you, Chair. On the issue of the land care and the agriculture grant, our recommendations of last year were quite clear on that. Just to suggest, what we said is that these two grants should be merged into one Schedule 4 grant. And because they have overlapping objectives, the administrative burden on provinces will be minimized by the creation of only one agricultural grant, and provinces in which agriculture is the main commercial activity will be able to spend the new less stringent Schedule 4 grant creatively in accordance with their particular circumstances. That's what we mentioned in terms of the merging of the two. But I think National Treasury's view is that these two have very distinct objectives and it's perhaps currently better to keep them apart. I think, Conrad, can I ask you to answer the issue of the municipality's budget system and the operating in silos, and I think the question was, what does it make for difficult coordination of those issues?
Thank you, John. There are many places of overlap, particularly in respect of housing and transport and the infrastructure services. However, I suppose what would be required is to more closely define which functions municipalities take relative to provinces to avoid this type of overlap that does tend housing function should be at the municipal level where it can be coordinated with water, sewage, roads, and refuge removal services. But there are many cases where there's a lot of overlap and a lot of confusion.
Thank you. I think the issue here is that the general problem of coordination, because of the concurrent functions of different departments, and sometimes there are these overlaps. So, you know, sometimes it's not just between municipalities and provinces, but between national government and provinces. And I think the budgeting processes, because each sphere of government has its own act for budgeting, it may not be as easy to get coordination of these different budgeting processes. And I think it's something that perhaps the budget process teams from National Treasury may need to consider.
I hope all the questions have been responded to. I'll take... Oh, consult, yeah. Oh, you are... Okay. Let's give FFC the opportunity. They will still consulting each other. We are done. But Mr. Bamsi feels like he hasn't responded to his question.
Yes. See, the Minister indicated that on page 18 of his address, by 2010 we will have close to 190,000 police officers on our team. Electronic fingerprints and lockers will become the norm. Okay? Following it. Yeah. You didn't get that,
but
you
were
saying.
Yeah, I think
we're following
the question.
He did that in the website. Now, my question, therefore, is this, that the police services and Home Affairs are not talking to each other as far as the fingerprints are concerned. Now, who is going to monitor to ensure that there will be value for money and not wasted expenditure? Expenditure if one department is not speaking to the other. In other words, if somebody is murdered on the scene of a crime, that person's fingerprints are not on a police database. No. The person is alleged that Mr. X is a murderer, and Mr. X is not on the police database. So they are left with a set of fingerprints. The only way to verify who an individual is if the fingerprints can be fed into the database of Home Affairs. Now, if it is a constitutional requirement, it cannot be done because somebody's rights are being violated. I put it to you that in your deliberation, when that was being passed, you also look at it in terms of your own report here that you picked up now. You are saying about forensic pathology services that you're taking over from police services. Not you, but shifted from the police service to the health department, etc. So effectively, one department must speak to the other in order to get results. Now, I know for a fact that in some instances, this is not done. And we are a case now in limbo, simply because people are told that we cannot examine this, the fingerprint further because it's a constitutional, the constitution does not allow police service to investigate further because that fingerprint is not on the database. I want to know if it won't. It's not part of your job to ensure at the end of the day money is not going to be spent on having a very sophisticated electronic fingerprinting. That you want to take into account to ensure that there is not very much money because at the end of the day you are arrested.
Right. Right. Before you respond, FFC, I'm going to take the last two. Members, so that you can respond to all of them at the same time. And if need be, National Treasury on the last question. If need be, you can respond or make some additions. Okay, Mr. Mbili.
Thank you, Chair. No, it's working now. Chair, thank you. The suggestion, Chair, here being made by Honourable Commissioner in his view that the housing should function, the housing allocation should be better managed at the municipal level. I want the second issue come to chair here of a very disturbing trend where, more especially during this time of the year, the housing department, the provincial housing department will dispense funds, large sum of funds to the municipalities. I suppose that is with the intention of making their books clean. But the issue here, then the following year, they will reapply for the additional allocation. But the issue here is that we are all aware of the constraints that this municipality is facing of capacity. And why the housing delivery is a priority and it cannot be shared? What is your take? What can be done vis-à-vis addressing the issue of capacity constraints in the municipalities and this disturbing trend, in my view, of just dispensing funds with the view of accelerating the issue of house delivery, because in my view it's not working. Thank you.
Honorable Robinson.
Thank you, Chair. I have a general question about the new conditional grants, the community library services, which is being I'm delighted to have. I'd just like to know, it is going to make provision for infrastructure and for books. I'd like to know what provision is made for the funding of the salaries of librarians, where there is no infrastructure. I could understand that the salaries would need to come later, but where there are already libraries which are unresourced, would that money be made available immediately? Where is it coming from, and how are we going to monitor it, that this money is spent? Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. FFP, you may respond.
Yeah, I just want to respond on the previous question on money to be transferred. The whole purpose of the DOR is absolutely ensure that no money is transferred to an entity that has no capability or capacity to use that money. So the transferring officer is his responsibility to make sure that the plans and all the structures are in place that will ensure that this money are not spent. So if that is the case, if you give that, the conflict is the wrong, and someone has to hold them accountable, but it's not as if the parliament or the president does not hold them accountable because they are doing things to as for the next one,
let me just talk a little bit about the Honorable Bamche's question on the forensic pathology services. I'm not sure that in terms of the FFC's work, we would, firstly, the grant now goes to the provincial health, but it's in health, it's moved. The program itself has been moved from South African Police Service to the provincial health department through the national health and the conditional grant. Therefore, it's now health. Now, the question that you are raising in terms of the finer details of the processes that actually take place there, from our side, we can't actually, we're not in a position to respond to that, but fortunately we've got people from the National Treasury that would probably have a view, because they participate in the process of approving some of these grants, this conditional grant, so they might be able to respond better on that one. The community library services issue, we had some discussion very preliminary discussion, and I think Dr. Mukugu here was one of the people that was involved, so I think he can actually respond to that. Do you want to say anything? And also the details of what the money is actually spent for in the process. We don't work on those kinds of minor details. We work on the principles and the framework around the grant, and then the details is for the relevant departments. So maybe National Treasury might want to say certain things about that.
Mr. Bansi, I'll just stop you because I can see you want to maybe follow up. You know, most of the questions are relevant to National Treasury. And I would ask National Treasury to take them on board as you make your presentation. Don't respond now, you will take them on board as you make your presentation. I want to thank the FFT.
Sure.
Honorable Bumps, National Treasury is the right.
No, I know. But I just want to see, I want to understand. For me, that's the first time I've been in contact with the Fiscal Commission for some time on other matters, generally broad issue. Now when I'm asking for something specific, I find this commission can't respond. Right? Now, I'm trying to understand the role of Fiscal Commission. Okay? Because you are supposed to be the eyes of civil society, and you engage Treasury. Right? And you figure they are saying that on a number of issues, and we would like to know what sort of monitoring mechanism does the Fiscal Commission play, if at all, or simply to engage them in discussion, and if you are to something be satisfied with what goes there, you push it through. I don't know how constructive do you engage Treasury. Maybe if some other Treasury can respond, but that's it.
Yeah, I think in this case, either you defend or but what is in the document. I think that's what's needed.
Thank you, Chair. Can I just respond to that question? I think we have to have a clear idea about what the role of the Commission is. The role of the Commission is defined in Chapter 220 of the Constitution. We're not a civil society body, we're a statutory body. And our role is very clear that we have to make recommendations on the equitable sharing of national revenue, and the minister has to take account of our recommendations when he presents the division of revenue. But and it's in that context that we are responding today. So it's clearly within that context, it's within the context of the Intergovernmental Fiscal Relations Act as well. On the issue of the specificities of that particular question, I think it is the Commission's role is not to monitor how the grant. The Commission's role is to ensure that there is an equitable sharing of national revenue, taking into account Section 214(a)(j) of the Constitution, to the extent to which those allocations are efficiently dealt with. Yes, we do monitor. We have a budget analysis unit here headed by Mr. Kwanzaa Bankar, and we will, in the next few days, with the Select Committee on Finance, be dealing with each specific department on those particular monitoring issues. So I think that would start as from the 28th of this month. And we will then make available to the House and to Parliament some of those specificities with respect to those different departments and those different allocations. But it will be within the context of the DOR Bill, and it will be within the context of the MGA and within the mandate of the Commission itself.
Yeah, thank you, FFC. Actually, what the minister earlier on referred to, that portfolio committees and select committees must take the responsibility. And it therefore presents the challenge to us as Parliament that the monitoring and the oversight over those grants should be vigorous. We'll break for tea, 10 minutes, then come back. Thank you, FFC.
Thank you. Without any waste of time, I give you this opportunity to present before us.
Thank you very much. Two of us are going to speak, but we have got with us our lawyer, just in case things get serious as we proceed. What we will do in the two parts of the presentation is to just give an overview of the processes pertaining to how we produce the Division of Revenue Bill, and specifically how we have approached this year's bill, so that we don't have to go into the minute details of the bill, which isn't markedly different from the Act, which is being implemented this year. So we'll draw your attention to the specific changes that we have made and why, without specific reference to the clauses, though. And then there will be a presentation that just highlights the specifics about the division of revenue, both the vertical and the horizontal, and it will focus specifically on what are the reasons why some of the allocations are shifting in particular ways, which is mainly just to explain the impact of the demarcation, the last demarcation process, which begins to only take effect for provincial allocation in the financial year that's coming. Now, may I just draw the committee's attention to the fact that the printers have let us down. Some of the bills have missed a batch in these things that are bound here with a stapler. So some bills might just not have pages 17 to 32. We apologize for that error, because the ones that we opened yesterday and looked at ourselves were complete and quite in order. So it looks like there were a few batches that were not complete. So in case you find that out, we've got copies now that are complete to replace that.
That's how they say. Now I understand why you brought the lawyer along. I understand, because there is a big, big mistake presenting to budget an incorrect document. It's incorrect because it was incomplete as the minister presented it. So you have, I don't want to complete the statement.
No, I understand, Mambu. I presume that but we most of the bills are complete, and the bill that was done or submitted to the printer is in fact complete with all the pages. But there was just a slight slip. These things get bound in verses, so you get one or two which don't have one rim. I don't know how to call this thing. In which case they have been replaced, by the way. So the bills that you will have before you now are complete. Right?
Can I just add that it is not indeed, it's not the National Treasury's oversight, it is indeed the administration's oversight, and the principal it's not parliament. So it's not that we minister submitted the bill to the National Assembly yesterday, that it was an incorrect document from our side. It was an oversight, or something went wrong with the printing of the document by parliament.
And the one at the minister tabled weekly, we checked each page was there. So when he tabled the full bill. So we confident that the minister tabled the entire
bill. You know, it's quite interesting the way you're defending national president. It's quite interesting, but anyway.
Can I also defend national president? The one they presented to me is also complete.
So you are one of the legislators. All right, let's continue.
Thank you very much, Chair. Now, this bill, which we are going to walk you through, is a requirement of Section 76(4) of our Constitution. And it has got 50 clauses, with Schedules 1 to 7 setting out the allocation. First schedule setting out the main division of revenue. The second schedule indicating the split of equitable shares for provinces. Three, the split of equitable shares for municipalities. And then the rest being conditional grants. Then at the back, it would be required of any bill, there is a memorandum of object. And then there is an explanatory memorandum that attached to the bill, which is also a legal requirement. That explanatory memorandum does become quite important because it explains everything, at least insofar as the equitable shares are concerned. So in a way, it should be possible if one gets the data that we have used to use the information that's set out there to check whether the allocations that we arrive at are indeed correct. We also have appendices to the bill, which is the framework explaining each one of the conditional grants. And in fact, some of the questions that came up on the conditional grants earlier on are quite easily answered by just looking at the appendices, which is the framework that relates to this grant for provinces and municipalities. Now, just some of the key considerations and our approach in drafting the bill. Because this is an annual legislation, we don't reinvent the wheel every time we prepare it. We use the current act as a point of departure. And we ask ourselves the four questions that are set out here. In other words, the first thing is to make sure that there are clauses that are either repetitive within the bill itself or repeat things that are provided for in other pieces of legislation, be they pieces of legislation which have always been in existence, or pieces of legislation that have just been passed. In particular here, what we try to do is to rationalize and make sure that all the things that are required in the PFMA and the MFMA, we don't continue to ask for them in this legislation. Secondly, we also look for new things that may have come up which necessitate that either existing clauses be amended or new ones be introduced in order to cater for those new developments. Thirdly, we check the bill for gaps that we may have identified when we implement the act that is in place. So some of the clauses that we have changed or insertions of new clauses are informed by the desire to close the gap. One particular example in this regard, and we'll come to it, is in relation to dealing with emergency, because we realize that there might have been a gap in this legislation or an unintended consequence, as you wish, which is in fact the last question. What we also sometimes find is that there may be provisions which, in the way in which they are written, may prohibit certain things or allow other things, in which case they would tend to have unintended consequences. So we clean the bill or amend it to deal with that. Now, the very critical principle that informed the way in which we approach the bill. This becomes important because for every clause on which there is some contention sometimes between ourselves and other departments or other agencies that are affected by the bill, it becomes important to test whether, in fact, the differences do not arise because people are overlooking some of these principles. For everything that we think can be provided for in this legislation, we must have to make sure that it's consistent with other pieces of legislation that we know of or that are out. That becomes very important, paramount to the Constitution, so that we don't bring a piece of legislation here that conflicts with existing legislation. Secondly, we also approach the bill with the understanding that there are other pieces of legislation, sometimes that originate from sectors, passed by Parliament, which are intended to deal with what happens within the sectors. So we try not to duplicate that, and we try not to use this legislation to sort of regulate the conduct or the relationship between the sector and other players in the sector concerned, because that may not be right. I mean, this is largely dealing with issues pertaining to finance and the flows thereof. What we also try to avoid is to load the legislation with a whole lot of administrative issues, which can best be dealt with through correspondence between two parties that may be affected, or whatever sectors can have within their realm. But sometimes, because people understand the power of money and the power of law, then the inclination is to try and sort of make provisions in this legislation to deal with those kinds of things. So we try and avoid that. But in avoiding that, what we try and do to accommodate some of these issues is to encourage departments, in particular that administer grants, to develop the framework and include in the framework, which also carry the same force as, almost the same force, I would say, as all the provisions of the bill, to accommodate some of those admin issues which define the relationship between the departments and the provinces or municipalities that receive grants in the framework. Two balances that we try to strike with the way in which we approach the bill is to make sure that the division of powers and responsibilities, as set out in the PFMA and the MFMA, is kind of maintained and reinforced rather than undermined by the way in which we approach the bill. So in other words, if a power or authority is given to an executive authority of a department, we are very careful not to use the bill in a way that could reverse that or in a way reduce its significance. Similarly, in relation to the relationship between spheres of government, we try and make sure that we do not inadvertently take away the power and the authority that might vest in an executive authority, be it the executive council of a province or the executive council of a municipality, and give it to another sphere of government or a department inadvertently, which is another tension that needs to be managed in relation particularly to conditional grant. Now, having that background, we have then taken out certain clauses in this bill because they've either become redundant or, for one reason or the other, they don't meet the criteria that we described earlier. The clauses that deal with cross-boundary issues, which we had inserted to provide for the transition, have become redundant, so we took them out. The clause that deal with the responsibilities of the Auditor General in relation to the auditing of conditional grants, we have taken it out because the Public Audit Act sufficiently covers that in our view. The clauses that deal with municipal capacity building and also those that deal with risk management. New clauses
clauses that have been inserted or existing ones that have been amended relate to the Caltrain rapid rail, because last year was, this financial year running, was the first year we had to make certain provisions in a particular way. Now, we have had to amend that in line with the fact that it is the second year that this is running, and it has got to be run in a particular way. There is a new grant, the 2010 FIFA World Cup Stadium Development Grant. We have had to make provisions pertaining specifically to that grant because it is unique, but also very big, and we have had to define the relationship between national government, represented by the Department of Sport, and the municipalities that are the host cities in such a way that, if possible, we can avoid having very long agreements and incur unnecessary lawyer fees. But where this is unavoidable, we also have left the door ajar for it. There is also a bulk infrastructure grant which is new, which is going to flow via the Department of Water Affairs. So we've got a clause that relates to the relationship between the National Department of Water Affairs and municipalities in this regard, which seeks to balance the fact that the schemes would be built for municipalities or for the benefit of municipalities and within their jurisdiction, with the fact that the funding will have to be on the vote of the Department of Water Affairs. So the clauses require that the National Department of Water Affairs must interact with the municipalities in a way that ensures that one of the questions that came up earlier about the integration of plans with the IPPs of municipalities, that integration takes place. So municipalities will not just see that there is a water scheme springing up and they see it there, it's left there for them to operate and they don't know where it comes from. They engage to make sure that there is a kind of orderly build up first to undertaking feasibility, ensuring that the municipalities understand what the feasibility generates. They accept that there will be costs associated with operating and maintaining the facility, and there is an understanding, because it's going to be jointly owned, possibly sometimes, in most cases, by more than one municipality. Therefore, they must have an agreement in terms of how they will run it and maintain it in the period of in the life of over its life.
A word of caution on this grant: you must always write it in full, to call it in full. Bulk infrastructure grant. You must never abbreviate it.
We will probably call it. We will probably have to call it infrastructure grant for bulk. The project registration one, we have made very explicit and clear provisions now, which in the first instance acknowledge the value of project registration, because they enable the department whose programs are funded through the municipal infrastructure grant to get information from municipalities that they need for a variety of reasons. So the bill is crafted in such a way that it permits project registration. What it also seeks to do, though, in the second instance, is to make sure that the registration of projects does not hinder the speed of implementation. So it must happen, that's what the bill prescribes.
Prior to the start of the
financial, okay to do that, they should capture it somewhere and advise the municipalities accordingly. But secondly, if it happens at a time when the financial year has already commenced, there must be an explicit understanding that it will not delay implementation of projects. However, in no way should project registration end up being tantamount to project approval. In other words, the project cannot continue unless it has been registered and so on and so forth. We have made a provision for allocations pertaining to emergencies just to reinforce and align between with section 16 and 25 of the Public Finance Management Act. And we have simplified the exemption clause. Now, I need not go through the schedule there because nothing has been changed in terms of the number of schedules. What I will ask now is that Mr. Brown should just simply go through the division of resources and some of the key things to note in relation to the shift.
Thank you, Mr. Puzile. Honorable Chair. Basically, what I'll go through in some of the aspects here is information that's captured in detail in Chapter 8 and in NHE of the budget review. And NHE is also part of the Division of Revenue Bulk as well, that has the of the printed Division of Budget Bulk as well. Now, Chapter 8 of the budget review summarizes the division between the three spheres of government actually in detail, and NHE explains some of the policy that underpins that, basically together with Chapter 7 of the budget review there. Now, NHE also provides for us a platform to which is legally required that we respond to the recommendations that the FFC has made, but also where we need to in detail explain how the equitable share of provinces and local government operate. So all of that is basically then covered in NHE. Now, also as part of the bill, a detailed conditional grant framework for each conditional grant that is in the system. Now, these are still drafts. Some of the comments that are made by the FSC in the green document, we still have time to also take some of those things into account because we will only really be presenting those by the 14th of April. Now, in those frameworks, we've got measurable outputs, we've got conditions, we've got the allocation criteria. We look at, we also highlight some of the performance of the grants there, and information that relates to planning for the following year there as well, and also the responsibility of national departments in terms of administering those grants. And for health grants, also in line with some of the recommendations made by the FSC, is a process to review some of those grants there. Then the appendices E3 to E8 highlight mainly all the allocations that go to municipalities in detail. Now, this is quite important for us because municipalities, as we speak, are busy preparing their budget. And they will be tabling, at least I think for the latest by the 1st of April, they must table their budget. So they need this kind of information also to be able to enable them to table their budget there. So we've got all the detail in terms of national transfers that goes to them contained in those appendices there. In terms of the fiscal framework, this is just a snapshot on how the division of revenue has been crafted. Of the additional 89.5 billion rand, this slide just shows how much of that money goes to national government, how much goes to provinces, and how much would then go to local government there, in line with the priorities and the discussions that went through throughout the year there. And this slide, which is in NHE, table E3, just explains in detail further all those transfers that go to municipalities, that go to provinces, conditional and unconditional, and also the share that then remains with national government after taking into account debt service costs, the contingency reserve, and all of that there. Then this table E5, I think, is Schedule 1 of the Division of Revenue Bills, and that just shows how the division has actually then been affected there. Then this point, the next part of this presentation is quite important. If members and the chairperson can remember, we the provincial boundaries and local government boundaries have been realigned And one March 2006, they really took effect. Now, at the time, we could reorganize and realign all the allocations that go to municipalities. So municipalities, as we speak, the budgets that they implement are now based on the newly demarcated municipal boundaries. But when this took effect, it was too late to reorganize provincial budgets to be in line with that, with the revised boundaries. So then the inclusion of certain clauses in the 2006 Division of Revenue Act so that we can manage that transition period. But the agreement was then that from 1 April 2007, provincial budgets must be realigned with the new provincial boundaries. Now what we have done, basically, we have reorganized the equitable share formula, which transfers quite a great sum of national transfers to provinces there with the new boundaries. So the structure of the formula remains unaffected, basically. But the data that supports the formula was reorganized to take into account the boundary change. There, we looked at, for example, the re-benchmarking of the general household surveys. We said that they assisted us to update a lot of the information that we use in the formula to realign that with the boundary. But some of it, which is the one, the economic activity, one which constitutes about 1% of the formula, because of certain technical aspects, they couldn't reorganize to the new boundary. The 2000 income and expenditure survey as well, that which supports the poverty component, also could not be reorganized with the new boundary. But part of that poverty component have been reorganized because it's driven by the population shares, and those population shares have been reorganized to the new boundary there. And another, what we did as well, we've updated the formula basically with all latest information there. So even our school enrollment information, which is captured in the census, have been reorganized. We use 2006 enrollment figures supplied by the National Department of Education. That has also been reorganized to the new boundaries there. And we also now use the 2006 mid-year estimates in the formula as well. Now, because the formula in the past used moving averages, let me give you an example. So we've been using 2001 census, 2002 JHS, 2003 and 4 JHS, and we've used averages of that to basically smooth the impact of any data update on provincial allocations there. Now, we're discontinuing that for a number of reasons. There tends to be a lag in the statistics if we use a moving average. Let me give an example. If we, for example, include 2005 GHS, the 2005 GHS captures population migration quite better than the 2001 census, for example. Now, what you then do, you only take into account reality, which is very close to us. 20% of the formula will then take into account, for example, that part. And what we felt is there's too much of a lag. We've got inward migration into our urban centers, and we need to capture that quite accurately. Hence the decision to discontinue the use of moving averages there. But at the same time, there were a number of changes in the structure of our statistics as well. And it was really difficult to then go back and reorganize some of that statistic also in line with the new boundaries there. Then the next one is normally when we update the formula with the latest available information, we will phase in the impact so that the budgets of provinces are not really disturbed. But what we have this time around, because of the demarcation, in Northwest, which loses quite a big chunk of its expenditure responsibility, those schools, clinics, and facilities, the expenditure responsibility that relates to that shifted, and they must fund it from 1 April. It's not something that we can phase in, for example. Northern Cape population increases by 21%, which means they've got an expenditure responsibility that they need to fund, which is something we cannot phase in But we have made a preliminary assessment of provincial budgets during January, and what we have picked up is the budgets at least show quite a good resemblance with the formula itself, but also with reality in terms of the expenditure responsibility that these provinces will have to undertake. Now, what governments agreed was provinces must now prepare their budgets, table these budgets. We will closely monitor these budgets as we move along, and that will basically inform how we then deal with certain shocks that may have happened that we couldn't, for example, pick up there. Now, these are the equitable shares, and they are realigned. And if one already looks at this equitable share and you go into Northwest, for example, you're going to pick up that the Northwest 2007 and 8 allocation decreases from 12.3 billion to 11.9 billion. We expected that, given that a large chunk of the province is shifting to Gauteng and to Northern Cape, for example. So we're quite comfortable with that kind of realignment that we see there. When it comes to conditional grants, some of the conditional grants have been reorganized as well in line with these boundaries. Then future work on local government and provincial fiscal framework is the issue around, for example, that was raised by the honourable member around housing accreditation. And we, actually in the draft 2007 Division of Revenue Bill, we actually had that clause out because we thought the Department of Housing can actually deal with the issue around accreditation in their own legislation. That, and they're coming back to us and say, look here, it helps us in the Division of Revenue Act, and we want to see that so that they can speed it up. But we need to at least put mechanisms in place now for the Department of Housing to speed up the issue around accreditation. Some of the conditional grants, we continue to review our conditional grants in line with what the FFC is also proposing there. And some of the grants that we introduced, like the community libraries one, the FET colleges one, those are your kind of temporary kind of grants that we bring in so that we institutionalize some of the expenditures relating to those programs. And once those are institutionalized, we actually then phase those allocations into the provincial equitable share there. On the local government front, RFC levies have been abolished. We provided temporary in the local government equitable share a replacement for RFC levies and joint services board levies. But we are in the process of finalizing a replacement for that. A discussion document has been circulated as well on our website, and discussions around replacement of that is continuing. Then in the controversial, I don't know whether I use the word controversial, but the issue around the EDI restructuring is also an issue that's on the radar screen that we're closely basically looking at there. And issues around powers and functions are also issues that are important because they have impact on the fiscal arrangements between the spheres there. On the FFC's proposals, the FFC highlighted, I'll quickly glance through some of the key proposals that they've made, and I won't talk into detail because we've got it in NHE. These are just basically a snapshot of those issues that they've touched on, or the aspects or main program that they touched on. I'll a bit talk through some of the issues here. A significant percentage of the recommendations have been taken into account. Now, on the one that we didn't take into account, and I say we, maybe I should say government didn't take into account, because there's now people who say brown view of the world. There's the issue around the housing allocation formula. Now, on housing, there's a number of issues there. The first one relates to what the FFC raises is that too much of an urban bias to housing at the expense of rural development, and we need to address that. Now, how we respond to that part is to say housing is indeed an urban problem. If one looks at certain trends, you'll see that the demand of housing is mainly in urban areas. But having said that, our allocations that we table, which are contained on page 40 of the bill, will show that those rural provinces, actually their allocations are growing rapidly. Rapidly, basically even, I'll talk anything between 15 to over 22% at the rate at which they are growing. So, although we take into account the need for urban housing, we, in terms of how we allocate, we don't forget about rural housing as well. Now, on the formula itself, as it was the issue around, we need to use traditional housing in the formula, we need to use the development potential in the formula, and we need to use delivery capacity in the formula. Now, government acknowledges parts of that, and hence the formula that's been used to make this allocation takes into account traditional housing as part of the backlog, takes into account the development potential. But what it doesn't take into account is the issue relating to delivery capacity. Because if you take delivery capacity into account in a formula, you may end up negating what the FFC wants to achieve. And at the end of the day, if you look at some of the delivery capacity and provinces that are struggling to perform in terms of these grants, you'll find that they are mainly rural. So if you include that in the formula, all the allocations may in any case then go to urban centers there. Then another aspect that we don't agree on is the issue around cost variation. And what the FFC is proposing is that the formula needs to take into account cost variation as there are different costs in delivering houses for different provinces. What we say is, number one, we need to think around simplicity of the formula firstly, because the formula as it stands is already a complicated formula. And if we're going to make an analysis of this, an addition of a component like this one will have probably a minimum impact on the distribution of these resources. That's the one aspect of it. But the other aspect of it is the cost of some of the inputs even vary, not just cross provinces, but they vary within a province, for example. And the example that one will use is if you buy cement in Midrand, for example, you'll find that a bag of cement in Midrand is 55 rand probably a bag. But if you go to other parts of Pretoria, you find that a bag of cement is probably 40, 43 or 44 rand a bag. How do you deal with those cost variations becomes an issue. So it will help if the FFC can actually also come up with some kind of a proposal how we can capture some of those things in a formula there. On the basic services component, mainly it relates to the 130 rand that we use as a benchmark in the formula to allocate for basic services. What we're saying there is, in any case, the way the formula is structured, it already provides more than the 130 rand for municipalities. Actually, the minimum amount, I think, is about just over 195 rand per capita for basic services already there. But what we agree on is we need to review basic services quite in detail, so that it informs future allocations for basic services, and we are doing a bit of work on that front. The development component, last year, we actually, government agreed with the FFC around what it proposes on the development component, but subsequent to that, we engaged with the Department of Provincial and Local Government, DPLG, and they've come up with a proposal for this. Now, we are in the process of assessing that proposal, and we will be responding to that when we table the 2008 budget is then tabled. On land care and CAP, the Comprehensive Agricultural Support Program, clearly the grant purpose are really different, and it will not be possible to merge the two. Land care looks at issues relating to soil preservation, to deal with soil degradation, in some aspects poverty and that. But on the Comprehensive Agricultural Support Program, it's mainly to deal with the beneficiaries of the land reform kind of program there. So I think there is a bit of divergence in the purpose of those grants. With the hospital revitalization, the proposal is that this grant be merged with the infrastructure grant for provinces there. And what we basically say in there is, firstly, we need to relook at how we deal with hospital construction moving forward. That's the first aspect. So we're going to review hospital the hospital construction program over the next few months, and the result of that review will basically also inform the allocation for 2008 in there. And on me, the municipal infrastructure, grant, the issue around maintenance, I think we need to take into account that this grant augments municipal budgets, and it assists municipal budgets to roll out infrastructure for the delivery of free basic services there. And granted, there may be capacity variation between municipalities. Some are poor, some are in a position to deal with some of the maintenance issues that relate to that. But primarily, the grant is to augment existing revenue. We expect municipalities to provide for the maintenance of municipal infrastructure from own resources. We are also, as I've indicated, reviewing the local government fiscal framework. And part of that review may also touch on some of the issues relating to what the FFT has raised on the maintenance. That I think that's the next discussion. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, FFT. Okay. Oh, sorry. My apology. Because we are talking about the grant. They are the advocates of the grant, that's why. Thanks, National President. I'll give over to my leader, comrade.
Okay, we have a bit of a problem. I see members are leaving, and this is just the time when I need them most. Mm-hmm. Mr. Harry. I just need your face. Yeah, no, I just need your face for a few minutes. If you could be part of the meeting. Yeah, but it comes with your voice. Look, unless there are people that have questions that they think if their questions are not properly addressed, we may not agree to this bill. Unless there are those questions. If there are such questions, I'm going to request that we formally consider and adopt the bill, and the questions for clarification can then be addressed. There are other questions that came up with the FFC that I would imagine National Treasury is ready to address. But I know that there are people that I have just kept for purposes of being available until such time that we have formally considered the bill. And, unless there are people who say, no, if mine is not addressed, this bill will not be agreed. Are there any people who feel that strongly? If not, can I then read the motion of desirability? Or is the question? I beg you? No, you're going to have time to look at all of you at the same time. But are there questions? And, I mean, if I could just get an indication where the questions will be so that we can, I mean, note the hand and then we move on. No. Ms. McCartney. No, but, I mean, why don't you just quickly ask it? And then it will be responded to after.
Thanks, Chairperson. I just want to ask a question in relation to the provincial equitable share. Especially with regard to provinces like the Northwest, which have lost a chunk of the rural parts as a result of the realignment process that was concluded last year. I want to check, in the place of that rural grant or subsidy that usually goes to the rural provinces, what is it that the department has put in place, just to capture the needs that are there in the province, because I would suppose that even though the province has lost quite a number of, say, even though the province's population size has decreased, I think it still faces the same challenges that were there before. Thanks.
Okay. I'm in a very difficult situation here. Ms. Mokoto says her question can be dealt with. It won't affect the adoption. Can we then move on and read the motion of desirability? That in the opinion of the committee, this legislation is desirable to provide for the equitable division of revenue anticipated to be raised nationally among the national, provincial, and local spheres of government for 2007 financial year, and the responsibility of all three spheres pursuant to such division, and to provide for matters connected therewith. Agreed. The report is as follows. The Portfolio Committee on Finance, having considered and examined the Division of Revenue Bill, which is Bill 3 of 2007, Section 76 sub 1, referred to it and classified by the Joint Checking Mechanism as a Section 76 sub 1 bill, reports the bill without amendment. Agreed. Johnson. Having got the general consensus or sufficient consensus, the bill is agreed to without amendment. Can we then quickly take the questions? The question that Ms. Makoto raised and the questions that have been asked, in the absence of any other questions, can I respond to those? Thanks, Mr. Hadden. You are.
On the issue of the ruralness of Northwest being reduced, when that's correct, but also in large part, in fact, what Northwest has lost significantly from is the shift of the perhaps not so poor, but definitely the townships that are bordering the Gauteng. That's where the significance is arising. But in the formula now, the poverty component, which is 3% of the equitable share, is or uses the income and expenditure survey figures for the poorest 40%, let me say, people in a province. That variable is not quite sensitive to the ruralness or otherwise of a province, but generally, the ruralness and poverty tend to coincide. So if you use a poverty measure such as that one, in all likelihood, the redistributive impact of the formula that you would have if you had a rural component, in other words, rural versus urban population, is likely to be more or less the same. Not exactly, but more or less the same. Now, let me then go back to the questions that had come up earlier. I'm hoping that I'm going to help resolve them rather than make them more complex. Starting with the question that was asked by the Honorable Ms. Robinson on libraries. The conditional grant as currently structured does allow that some of the money could in fact be used to deal with the personnel or staff issues that we're talking about. But ideally, the staffing of the library should be funded from equitable share. I mean, because the conditional grant theoretically is not guaranteed funding that will continue forever. So we tend to shy away from encouraging the use of conditional grant fund to meet personnel requirements for delivering certain programs. Because what happens if then in the following year the funding mechanism changes? Theoretically, you could say that the money that was set out there to fund the salaries of these people disappears. So we prefer the equitable share for funding of staff. There was a question on accountability for conditional grants, which I thought was not adequately dealt with. The act that's being implemented now, Divisional Revenue Act, and this bill, set out almost more clearly, in my view, what the responsibilities of each of the role players are. Say the duties of an accounting officer, the duties of a transferring officer, receiving officer. So in a way, accountability derives from that. In addition to the accountability that derives from the various provisions of the Public Finance Management Act and the Municipal Finance Management Act. So in other words, if a conditional grant passes from a national department to a province, and it specifies that the money can only be used for this. This is how we will procure if the conditions or anything goes to that city. Then when those are violated in terms of what is contained in this bill in the Public Finance Management Act and the Municipal Finance Management Act, the various people might be held accountable for different things. For instance, the national department, if the report that it receives would allow it to defend that something is going wrong with this, it is within its right to step in, and the law allows that. And if it does this, then the accounting office of the National Department will be held accountable for continuing to transfer money when, in effect, the information that has been furnished to him or her ought to have shown that something is amiss. Similarly, the rules that pertain to procurement and financial management at the level where implementation takes place are very clear. If they are flouted at that level, then the bus will stop there. I need not go any further than that, I suppose, on that question. Now, the one that was a bit difficult is the one in relation to the forensic pathology services. The way I saw it is that there were many parts to the question. There is the specific grant which captured the Honorable Bamji's attention. The forensic pathology, with emphasis on pathology services grant. Now, the role of that is very, very limited. In fact, it's pathology services, not forensic, broadly defined. It's dealing with people who have died due to unnatural causes, whose death require that there should be an autopsy. And what this grant does is to facilitate the transition from having that function located with SAPS to locating it with HEP to deal with the conflict where the person could die as a result of contact with the police, for example. Now, if the police have got to also keep the cops and do that kind of stuff, the idea was that that could lead to contamination of evidence and so on and so forth, so that they have intended to do that separation. Something like that. So that's the aspect that this particular money deals with. You raise a separate, what I thought would be a separate issue, which is whether there are possibilities for cooperation between police and Home Affairs in relation to investigations and making use of of information that they may have on fingerprints and stuff like that. Without having checked the law, but just listening to the way the discussions normally go on or report, my sense was that, in fact, the police can have access to the Home Affairs information on fingerprints, if they so may. In fact, that is how I think they usually identify people who die and they don't have an identity document on them or something like that. They find them, they take the fingerprint, they go to Home Affairs, and Home Affairs says to them, look, the person who has died here from the information we have died here in or was so and so. So there's that kind of stuff. There was a development in relation to the electronic fingerprinting system that was intended to work almost like native, like the national transport information system, which is to link all the systems that government has in relation to fingerprinting, so that the police can have access to what Home Affairs has without having to talk to Home Affairs and stuff like that. So I think that the cooperation is there, and the law does not stop it from happening. I hope I...
No, you can't respond. You can only ask a supplementary question.
Okay. A supplementary question. Thank you, Chair. I hear what you think, that I'm not clear what the situation is myself. But the thing is that who does one speak to? I mean, it was not my intention to raise this here. But because I just by chance looked at your report and your report and did it on the same sort of a thing, and that is why I raised it. So the point I'm making here is that I think we need to check this out, whether it can't be said that somebody's rights are being violated. Right? Because if it is said that you cannot refer, you cannot take this information and use it in the court of law, then I'm arguing that then the amount of money that they're putting in, even if confidence, if unofficially information got to say who the individual is, in terms of match. If it goes to court, it will be thrown out. So, are there exceptions to the rule? In other words, whose rights are more important? The person who has been murdered, or the person who is a potential alleged murderer, but the Constitution now will protect the individual simply because you cannot violate the Constitution. That's the point I'm making, because then you bring a lot of money in for the different departments to talk, what is the net effect if you cannot get it out? So from that point of view, I'm requesting that if you, I'm not asking you for an answer, because it's not part of your brief, but when you're engaging with the police and with the judiciary, or whoever it is, in terms of legal matters, you say, now, is there a catch-22 here? And I make you believe there is a catch-22. If they catch 22, then a lot of potential alleged murderers are walking the streets. Thank you.
Okay. I really wouldn't want to be unfair and expect you to be in a position to be in a position to answer this question. Both the FSC and the National Treasury. I would imagine it's a question that we don't answer, but as members of Parliament, we have every right to take the matter to the relevant committees to engage with. The committee that is fortunate to be able to engage with this department at some stage is actually the budget committee. And I would imagine they would note this so that when they engage with the safety and security draft and the Home Affairs, perhaps they can raise it. Are there any further questions?
Yes.
Mr. Bunch.
The issue of poverty. I understand that there is no formal definition of poverty as yet, right? On page 103 of the Red Book, and made for no official poverty line has been adopted for South Africa. Now, if you are looking at the issues where you want to address poverty, and alleviate poverty, etc., until such time if you do come up with a definition, is there a possibility that you could run into contradiction when you're trying to address issues because your interpretation may well differ from other people's interpretation. And if that is the case, how would you resolve it? Have you found that your understanding of poverty is different to that of your colleague in
or you have come to a common understanding on how you have considered the issue of poverty. If so, what is that common understanding of how you address the issue of poverty?
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I know that the word is not used in the review, the word in the way the honorable member does could create the impression that we are in a hopeless situation. I mean, it's not as bad as that. There are various ways in which government, for practical purposes, defines poverty. The social security grants that government gives for children, for even for the old age, is based or are based on some kind of a mean test. So that is one measure. In other words, the Department of Social Development has got a measure of poverty that it uses to determine who qualifies for it. So it works because there are 11.8 million people who benefit from social security grants. By and large, I think most people would agree that the people who are getting those grants are those who should get them. Those who get them when they don't deserve them probably also know that they are doing the wrong thing because they know what the means test or where the means test put them. That's the one method. The second instance where we use or we have to confront matters of poverty outside of the formula, within the context of this formula that we use, is when we determine allocations for local government. There again, because government has got a policy of free services, water, electricity, sanitation, refuse removal, and so on, for households, that in that context are defined as poor if the combined income of the household is less than 800 rand per month. So there again, you can see. But what the issue of arriving at a common poverty line, so to speak, you know, what brings that to the fore is precisely the fact that what could happen inadvertently is that a person who is defined as poor in one set of circumstances may not be defined as poor in another set of circumstances within the same government. So that what you give in one hand or with one hand, you might end up taking all or part of it with another hand. So in essence, I can give you several examples of poverty programs that use some measure of poverty, which is not arbitrary by any means, but they look for a kind of a common thing that you can apply to everyone, and then you know that whoever is below that is poor and therefore qualifies for everything or a portion of everything and stuff.
But maybe just to add to that, the commission, what we want to then ensure is how we then use a measure like in this formula and how a government policy that is funded through this policy then needs to some kind of be in alignment in what you use. Let me give you an example. When we talk about no-fee schools, for example, or even the ranking of poor schools, we use the quintile system, which is basically based on what we then use in the formula itself. So we want to ensure that there's a kind of alignment in that as well.
Yeah, thank you very much. I think that explains the question very well. That then brings us to the end of the session. And, I'd like to take this opportunity to thank the National Treasury, the Financial and Fiscal Commission, the honorable members for taking your time at this difficult period. I know a lot of us were overstretched, especially after the tabling of the budget, and today being a Thursday when so many meetings are taking place because we normally don't meet on Friday. But also to say to members of the Finance Committee, we not only have the meeting that was scheduled for tomorrow, for
some logistical and technical reasons. That then brings us to the end of this mission, and both committees, the budget committee also is not meeting tomorrow, I'm informed, until we meet next week on Tuesday. And also to alert members of the finance committee that we have our debate on the Division of Revenue Bill on the 28th, that's Wednesday next week, in order to allow for the NCOP to proceed with it, because otherwise the NCOP cannot achieve the processes that require attention. So thank you very much for your cooperation and for staying to me for something.